Hello, welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, the Cinelings podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the easiest way is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at stevedunk5 or at everythingcanon. Today in the show, I'm talking to Tanya Bethaju all about her brand new book, Bruised, a fantastic sophomore release, which follows Daya, who ever since the tragic death of her parents, has struggled to deal with the aching deep in her heart. When she discovers the rough and tumble world of roller derby, she finds that perhaps this is the outlet she needs to medicate that pain. Bruised doesn't look to solve any of the bigger world issues that plague our daily lives. It's more concerned with the 6 inches in front of your face. Or, more specifically, how the day-to-day act of being a part of society, while at the same time immune to its whims, can cause someone who's experienced trauma to remain numb to it all. We talk about all sorts of things, including roller derby, the difficult but necessary topic of self-harm, Bruised, of course, and much, much more. While this is a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out, so if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now, but definitely double back once you've had a chance to read it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. Another reminder that on this podcast, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves. Each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, if we ever do that again, or each time we participate in the market. So please make sure you do that each and every day of the year. Tanya Bethaju is an English teacher and writer living in Vancouver, BC, my home province. She completed her English and education degrees at the University of British Columbia, then spent time in New York attaining her Master of Arts through Columbia University's Teachers College. Her writing life has mostly consisted of teaching writing for the past 18 years in Vancouver, where she has continually been inspired by the brilliant young people in her midst. Easy to do on the West Coast, too. Her 2019 novel, Kings, Queens, and In-Betweens, was hailed by just about everybody. I highly recommend it. But she's here today to talk about her brand new book, Bruised, which comes out March 23rd. Please welcome to the show, Tanya Bethaju. Hi, Tanya.
Hi. It's nice to be here.
Yes, thank you.
You're getting close with my last name. It's Bethaju.
Bethaju. I know. And we just talked about it offline, too. I knew I was going to screw it up.
Okay.
And it's not difficult. I'm just stupid. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Yes, I am. I was born on Vancouver Island.
Oh, cool. So was I.
Okay. Well, this is now I can tell you where, because usually when you say that, people are like, I don't know. Campbell River.
Oh, wow. Up there, hey?
Yeah. That's not even, that's only halfway. What do you mean up there?
Yeah. Far from Victoria, which is where I was born. But.
Okay. Perfect. Yeah. And my partners, all of their family is in Courtney and Comox, pretty much.
Oh, cool. Beautiful.
And my middle brother was born in Vancouver, and my oldest brother, who now lives in Vernon, was born in White Rock. So
awesome. And you're, but where are you now?
I'm in Ontario now. I'm just outside of Toronto now. Yeah. I haven't been, we left, I was young when we left. So, you know, had to stick with my parents who were, you know, providing for me. So right. I had no choice, but haven't been back for a couple of years, but been back many times since. And as you know, it's a wonderful place.
It really is. Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks very much for doing this. And one of the things I wanted to start off with was just as I've been doing the past 12 months, I hope you and your friends and family and loved ones are all healthy and safe.
Mm-hmm. They are. I'm really thankful for it.
All right. It's probably a little early, but you probably haven't done too much marketing yet, but it's coming and it's going to be different than the last time you marketed a book.
It really is. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you
like this time?
Yeah. Are you excited about that? Are you less excited? I mean, one of the big things that I love about authors is talking to them, but you know, I really like in the flesh thing, right? Like I like to, you know, look somebody in the eye and talk to them and stuff. So, and then for me, as part of your, you know, celebration, I love seeing, you know, authors out there in the world, line throngs of people telling them how great they are and how their book affected their life in this way or that way. So you're not going to get to do that this time.
No. I mean, I feel really lucky that when Kings came out, I was able to do all of the things and it was my first book out. So I got that experience and I feel really blessed for that. But it is going to be different this time. I'm sure there won't be any big fun launch like we had with Kings. But I've been to many book launches over the last few months, authors with their books coming out during this pandemic, and they've been beautiful and they've been celebratory and fun as well. So it won't be the same, but I'm still looking forward to it. I'm excited. And you know, like doing things like this or other little interviews here and there and that kind of stuff is, and even online, you know, conferences or festivals have actually been really wonderful in a lot of ways too. So I can't complain. I'm happy to get any kind of
for sure. And you know, I think you'll agree, I'm sure, this, if there is a silver lining, is, you know, doing it this way. And I actually hope some of it sticks around, because the reach is 100 to 1,000-fold.
Yeah, exactly. It's so much more convenient in a lot of ways too.
Right. It's very convenient. No doubt I've talked to somebody at some point the last 12 months who wasn't wearing pants or anything at all, but which is great. It's your kingdom, right? You get to do what you want.
Exactly.
The sophomore book is a big one, right? That's a big release in an author's career. So how are you feeling going into this one? Are you the type of person that sort of puts that pressure on yourself, or do you just take things in stride?
Somewhere in between that, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely heard all of the stories about the second book. And I don't know if there was any harder than King's. I think writing a book is hard and involves a lot of effort. And certainly both of them involved all of that. But I definitely felt differently about this one, only because, you know, when I started writing King's, set out to write that story down, I had no idea whether that was it for me. You know, I felt like I had the story in me and I was going to write it, and I didn't have any sort of intentions for what happened after that. But then, you know, I was super lucky to fall in with my same editor and publisher and work on Bruised. And this was not necessarily the story that I had always thought I had in me, but it was a really awesome story. I loved telling it, and I got really involved in it. It didn't, again, feel any harder necessarily than King's, except that, you know, some of the relationships in the novel were maybe trickier, but I felt like a little bit more prepared, certainly, to write this book because I'd been through it once. I'd worked with the same editor. I'd learned a lot from writing King's. And so I definitely felt like I was growing as a writer, and it was a good thing to be writing the second book for sure.
We'll talk a bit about that in a bit here, but you definitely, it seems like you did a lot of research for this book for sure. And it's on the page and it's in the back. I'm a cover to cover person. Like, I love thank yous and acknowledgments and author's letters and letters to the readers and prologues, all that stuff. And yours was great. And it's pretty evident, you know, the amount of effort and research you put into this book, in particular Roller Derby, right, which we'll talk about. How do you feel personally, though, about this book now? It's print, so it's too late. In between the books, learn anything, forget anything?
No, I feel pretty good about it. I did feel like I put a lot of effort into really trying to capture what I feel like is the magic of roller derby, even though I don't do roller derby myself.
I was going to ask you that, so that's okay.
Yeah, no, not something I feel capable of doing physically.
Right. Right.
Big a wimp. So, but I really admire it.
Wimps unite. I'm with you.
Yeah, it's all right. Totally.
Yeah.
things, I'm not a risk taker. Mental, not physical. I feel like I did the best I could. I reached out to the people that I thought would help me create some authenticity in my roller derby scenes.
Different book, other book.
Yeah, totally. But it's funny because that's, you know, when you talk about research, it's like I chose these two things that were super fun to research, you know, drag and roller derby. There's a lot of similarities in terms of like the community and the sort of color of both of those communities. And so it felt similar in some ways, because I was like diving into this really cool sport that I got to learn a lot about and try and create the atmosphere of.
What about though, like as a writer, I mean, how are you feeling about it? You know, your ability to tell a story, right? Whether it's roller derby or drag or whatever. Mm-hmm. Do you think you feel like that you've progressed significantly? You feel like you're like, man, that's, you know, not that you would go back and rewrite anything, but you're just like, you know, I think I'm, it's on the page. I can see that I'm getting better at telling a story.
Yeah, I do feel like that. I feel like Bruised is a better written book than Kings. Kings had a lot of my heart, of course, and so did Bruised, but I feel like I got better at telling, creating a character arc. I learned a lot from my editor, Jen Ung, and Simon Schuster about that. And so I had a better sense of, you know, what goes into a fully developed character right from the beginning. Whereas that with Kings, it was something that I really had to add in, I think, as I wrote the book in edits. But with Bruised, I do feel like my writing style is getting a little bit more natural and fluid. I'm getting more concise. I'm learning to, you know, notice when things don't need to be a part of a story. And then, yeah, I would just say the biggest thing is really learning more and more all the time about how to develop really authentic feeling characters.
Well, that's one of the things too that I will talk about again. You know, I really think you present your characters in a really tactile way, which is wonderful as a reader, you know, as somebody who enjoys good character work, because it's, you know, you can read Star Wars as much as you want, let's say, but like, I'm never going to be a Jedi, right? So it's, you know what I mean? But, you know, it's when you're writing, you know, contemporary, you know, characters that are, you know, set in this time and place and age in the world we live in, it's so nice when it's done well. And I think you do that very well. Where did this, when did Bruised, when did the seed plant, where did this come from?
Yeah, it's funny because, with Kings, like I said, it kind of was in me, and I have been percolating on this idea for many years since I did drag as a young person. And then with Bruised, it was almost the opposite. It was like literally me sitting down, trying to figure out what I was going to write next. Having written a bit of an idea for my editor before that, and her not really loving the idea, my initial idea. Mm-hmm. And so basically going back to the drawing board and sitting down and figuring out what story do I want to tell? Do I feel like I'm able to tell at this point? I still wanted to write YA. Mm-hmm. And so then I just started mining my interests or things that sort of, you know, caught my eye or have attracted me or appealed to me in the past. And roller derby was one of those things. And so I guess the seed in this case was the atmosphere and community of roller derby. And then from there, it sort of was like, well, okay, so what kind of human being would be attracted to this sport and why? And there was, that was how Daya came to be.
Before we get to Bruce specifically, one thing I like about both books is, you know, even though like there's a lot of sort of like saccharine moments in these books, right? There's a lot of heartfelt moments and intimate and beautiful moments between characters, not necessarily romantic, just, you know, wonderful shared experiences between people. But before you even realize it though, you know, you realize that there are serious conversations happening, you know, about the world and about the way we perceive, you know, the world and each other. Is that something that comes naturally to you? It must, because it seems to me that's like of the two books, that seems it's like two for two as far as that goes.
Yeah, well, I think that just comes out of thinking about the kinds of books that I like to read and,
right,
and how I like to receive my, you know, my worldviews and my messages and that sort of thing. That I love books, you know, YA books with a lot of substance and that are character driven as well. And so with both of these books, you know, representation and inclusion, those are things that I am constantly aware of as an English teacher and as a reader and as a writer. And so with my books, it's definitely something I'm constantly thinking of too, is like, who's going to be reading this? And, you know, who am I including? Who am I excluding? And how do I build a world that will like really resonate with folks who, especially the folks who maybe don't get to see that as often in literature. So yeah, that is definitely something that's deliberate and on my mind constantly when I'm writing.
Yeah. And this is a real, one of the things I, you know, scribbled down was, this is sort of like a real slice of life story. You know what I mean? It's not impactful really to anybody else outside these three blocks. You know what I mean? But it's, right, but it's massively impactful to the people in this story. Like, it's, you know, it changes some of their lives in significant ways. But I always love these stories where, you make the world sort of smaller. Mm-hmm. And because I don't know about you, but I get like anxiety all the time, just about a number of things. And it's really helpful to me when I can, you know, when I'm able to do that, that helps me focus sort of like, because if I think, stop for 1 second and think about, you know, the world's problems on a, like a macro level, I'm fucked. Like I'm totally screwed. Right. So, is that the way you, is this like therapeutic for you at all? Or is this just like, are you like that too? Or just, it's just me.
Just me.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I totally get what you're saying. I mean, I think for me as both a teacher and as a writer, I mean, I gravitate towards the stories that really zoom in on moments, small pieces of time. And it's something that I certainly encourage, I would say, as a teacher with students and when they're writing things too, you know, to start with those personal moments and the, like the bigger ideas, the bigger messages will come from those. They, you know, they always do. You write, read any good creative fiction, any stories, you know, it's these small moments that are sometimes dealt with, but of course we take away so much more. And so I think it makes it feel manageable to me. And it also is what I feel like makes the kind of writing that I really gravitate towards anyways.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not in real time, obviously, but it doesn't, how long does pass is in your mind? Because I mean, just at the end of the book is when she's just starting her second match. So not a lot of time passes. What would you say, a week? 2 weeks?
Well, in my timeline, I think that I have it at about 3 weeks.
Yeah. 3 weeks. Okay. All right. Not a lot of time. And which I also appreciate very much because sometimes, you know, when books go over the course of a year, it's just like you start asking yourself more questions at that point. Right.
Right.
So Bruised. And before we move on, I do, this was sort of a funny moment because, you know, I was just, somebody was confirming this interview with me the other day. And as the email came from Mackenzie Croft, I was reading the line, the special shout out to Canadian super publicist Mackenzie Croft. So I also, and I told her I'm forced to agree with Tanya that she is a super publicist. So I just want to say shout out to Mackenzie, who was awesome. All right. So anyone can Google Bruised and go to Goodreads and they're going to read the promotional language. But what's it about? Tell me what it's about to you.
For me, I think it's about what strength looks like. You know, with Daya, her journey is really to figure out, you know, that strength doesn't have to be brutal or physical, and that gentleness is where a lot of strength comes from and vulnerability. And so for me, the book is about her discovering that and hopefully about others realizing that that's true for them too. It's also about community. It's definitely about her being able to open herself up to more people in her life. I mean, she starts at the beginning pretty isolated, even though she has people around her. She definitely has a wall up to a lot of those people. And so she, I don't think she realizes it. I mean, I know she doesn't realize it at the beginning, but when she does enter roller derby for her own reasons, you know, that's really the start of those walls coming down. Because as I said before, roller derby is just this really incredible community and atmosphere. And I think it would be hard to be part of that without feeling part of a community. And so it was sort of the perfect vehicle for her discovering that there's so much value in actually connecting with people in a way that isn't physical, which is what she knows, right? Like physical contact. But here she realizes that there's that emotional contact that becomes really powerful too.
Yeah, that's one of the things too. She almost, you know, her parents died in an accident. She blames herself. Mm-hmm. And like you said, she's put up this wall, and she, you know, we are instinctually, we just sort of like fall back on what we know. And of course she's going to react the way she was taught to, you know, from her father, you know, which is indifference and closed off, right? Mm-hmm. Tough, yeah. Tough. She's got to act tough. But one of the things I love about this book is, Daya's a great main character, but this your entire cast is great. And she really doesn't stand a chance, does she? Because you surround her with a cast of characters that would turn the most hardened person, I think, into jello. How could you not? I mean, but this is sort of how serious the situation is. I mean, it's hard. I would hate to think about the alternative, like how, what Di's life would have turned out like, you know what I mean? Because we'll talk a bit about sort of like the self-harm that's going on, but you know, this, by surrounding her with so many, it's all, this is how important it is. This is how high this wall has been built, is that you have to surround her with people like Fee and Cho. And, you know, was that sort of part of the deal here? Is you're like, I need to surround her with a specific type of person, people, that's going to like each sort of like peel a layer.
Yeah. I think, I mean,
Shanti obviously is taking is doing, you know, I won't say, you know, a good chunk of the heavy lifting, but she just fulfills that one part, but there's more parts that need to come apart. Right.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, she's so irritated by her uncle and aunt who she lives with. And that kind of personality that they have, which is really, you know,
don't steal my thunder. I'm going to talk about Priam and Vicky. Don't worry. They're the best.
I was trying to think of like, who would annoy Daya the most, or like, just really bash up against those walls that she's put up. You know, Shanti kind of eases in a little bit in a way that some of the other characters don't. They just really, you know, she hits the wall with her face, basically.
Right.
And they were also, you know, fun and trying. I was trying to like, again, sort of create the atmosphere of roller derby and the kind of attitude I think that I've sort of seen or I've witnessed in people who actually play roller derby. And so I was thinking about all of the different kinds of personalities that might be involved, from like the really tough, not so fun folks to the really fun, playful, again, kind of overwhelming, but you know, big personality kind of characters. But yeah, they all sort of play a part in different ways. Even Kat, who is the tough sort of hard character, play a part in sort of poking holes in the walls that Daya has set up for herself.
Well, I definitely think, you know, yes, Kat is the captain of the roller derby team, and Shanti's sister, who is the, you know, there's a battle happening, you know, they're both fighting for Daya for different reasons, but Kat's definitely outnumbered. There's way more fun characters in this book. There's more Joes than Kats, that's for sure. And two of them are yes, Priam and Vicky, Daya's aunt and uncle, who of course are her guardians now. Legal guardians? I don't remember. I don't think you talked about it. Doesn't matter.
She mentions the papers going
through. Right. Who are... I don't know how to describe Priam and Vicky. They're out there in the best possible way. They are just this, you know, carpe diem, right? Like free-spirited folks, artistic, creative people. And like you said, completely clash with where Daya is at right now anyways. I don't even have a question. I just want to say how great Priam and Vicky are. They're so like, you know, talk about the levity this, you know, this book sometimes needs, because you do sort of go into some really serious, you know, issues for sure.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because that was an addition after I'd sort of written the first part of the book, and it was based on a suggestion from my editor to maybe introduce some levity and lightness.
Okay. Geez, I would hate to read the book before then. It must have been pretty depressing.
It did start out a little darker, because Daya's guardians at that point, her aunt and uncle at that point, were actually much more serious. And
I see.
Closed off. Yeah, so I took them in a completely different direction, as you can see.
No, it's great. And I laughed out loud a few times with the way they are, especially when, the Shanti stays over. But really, really funny. But you know, this leads to a really important conversation to have with her. You know, I call it the kitchen conversation. And this sort of leads to another issue where she didn't, you know, trauma can do this. It sort of clouds our memories in a lot of ways, right? And she doesn't necessarily remember her parents the way they ought to be remembered, for both parents. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, is there anything in this that's personal to you at all or anything? Because I really, you know, this idea that she didn't see her mother for the way that she really was. And, you know, there's a great line, you know, you wrote in it. And I'm just going to say, it says, I should have seen how her real strength was in the way she gently held space for both my dad and me and how little she needed muscles and force and fists to make us feel safe. You know, I really got really emotional during those scenes where she really started to realize that her mother, like, quietly, you know, moved mountains, I think you said, right? Is there anything personal in that, or is that just...
Well, partly. I mean, yeah. her relationship with her parents is definitely pulled from sort of cultural norms or cultural experiences that I've had. My parents are from Sri Lanka as well, and they're immigrated here. And that I've seen in other families.
And if this is none of my business, you can just tell me to just say, like,
I'm actually happy to talk about it because, you know,
it was written, like, it's really beautifully written. And I really love those parts. They might be my favorite, actually, where she's starting to realize, and with the help of Prem and Vicky, who are, that kitchen scene, I'm telling you, is dynamite. And, you know, that, like, I was just like, I was locked in for those two chapters where that whole thing goes down.
Thank you. Thanks. So nice to hear. It's just, it was definitely, really, I wouldn't say hard to write the scenes where she's reflecting back on her time with her father and with her mother. But it was, those were the moments where I had to really get present to her relationship with a father who had these expectations based on, you know, his own experience, which I've seen time and time again with immigrant parents. Mm-hmm. Including my own, you know, to some extent, and then also, you know, how the women, you know, the women in my family have certainly been sort of the rocks in so many ways and not necessarily given that credit. So tapping into those things, that's the real part for sure. Even though I've definitely fictionalized some aspects of their relationship, I was pulling on very real relationships or personas and roles, I guess, that I've seen in my own family, my extended family, as well as my close family, and so our immediate family. But it definitely was, you know, it's not completely made up, but it's not perfectly tied to my own experiences either.
Right. This wasn't a journey for you necessarily. It didn't, like, resolve any longstanding.
No, I think it, well, I mean, I think it was actually really great for me to explore some of those ideas about how immigrant parents sometimes have these expectations for their children, and to also explore those, like, gender roles within some families and that kind of thing. I think it was actually, you know, really powerful to be able to look at that and then also write it onto the page. I, you know, for a couple of the people who've already read the book, it's definitely resonated with them if their parents are also immigrants.
Right.
That's been kind of cool just to think about how it might resonate further than me.
Right. And of course, you know, only, you know, racists and idiots out there think, you know, other cultures are a monolith, but everyone has different experiences. And, you know, there's people, I hope people understand that, you know, the sacrifice a lot of these parents and families make by having to relocate, right? Yeah. For whatever the reasons they are that they're doing so. And they do it all for their kids. Mm. Like, you know, right? 9 times out of 10, it's mostly because they want a better life for their children. And I think in that sense, there is definitely, like you said, there's this sense of, you know, this culture has a different way of, you know, maybe in the household, the way households are ran. But I think there's a lot of truth in the messaging in that story, in this relationship that goes on. And I think that stretches to any race, creed, culture, whatever you want, right?
Agreed, yeah.
You know, the father is just, you know, he's a hockey dad. Well, he's a Canadian.
Yeah.
I don't even know how to skate, but it doesn't matter. I read books. Okay. I'm not an athlete. Leave me alone. he's a hockey dad, right? He's the one guy, that asshole up on the stands yelling, right, and stuff like that. But I mean, he's, and he's not. There's much more to him than that, and we get to that point. But one of the things I loved was when she, you know, again, back to that conversation where she's realizing so much about that she didn't understand about her mother. You drop a bomb about her father, and that's a really important part too. And I want to make sure people understand that, yeah, her father, he's tough, but there's a reason why, I think, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, not as an excuse, but also, but definitely, you know, it's coming from somewhere. He's not just this one-dimensional asshole, right?
No, absolutely. And then you don't really get into it, but I mean, I just know from personal experience, like a lot of that times is just, that's just, you know, the way this country deals with immigrants a lot of times too, right? It's not, oh, the system isn't always necessarily set up for success in a lot of ways. And so a lot of these families are forced to make a lot of sacrifices, right? He, you know, he's forced to give up a lot of things that he, his hobbies, the things he loved doing, just because. So just to put a pin in that, really great, wonderful, wonderful stuff. And, you know, if anyone has, you know, this book is about a lot of things, roller derby one of them, but that is that the, this family, the dynamic and the family structure is a huge part of it. And I think it's really important, and I really hope people latch on to that. Okay. Roller derby. I'm 40. I'll be 45 here soon, in a couple of weeks. So thank you. Yes. Which means I remember the long list of attempts at making roller derby mainstream over the decades now, right? Going back to, what was that? James Caan film, Rollerball in the 70s.
Right.
With that sweet poster that all the boys, we were like, look at that poster. Roller jams, roller games, roller derby, you know, all these shows in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And then, you know, we've had some films whip it and stuff like that. It always had, I'm just going to speak for myself. I never took it seriously because it had this like, which is such a bullshit man thing to say, because I always viewed it as it had this like sexualized pro wrestling stigma thing to it. Like I never took it seriously. But I fucking loved pro wrestling. So it's just a pure, you know, misogyny thing for sure. I admit that now as an adult, I can admit that. But as like a 10-year-old, it didn't matter, right? So what is it about this, you know, the sport that now I know different now. I've been to roller derby matches in the last, you know, X amount of years. I have friends that participate in it. And like, the shit is real. And it's a sport. And I can't do it. There's no way I could do it. So, I get it. And one of the things I do love about it actually, and I dropped a lot of that, you know, misogyny stuff a long, long time ago. Just so you know. But even in high school, like I was a punk rocker kid. So what I found that appealed to me was the DIY ethic, because that's such a punk rock thing too back then, right? So that was always appealing to me for sure. What was appealing to you about it? What was the thing, as you said, you were sort of thinking of things that appealed to you that would make a great story. What was it about roller derby that popped in your head?
I love that it's female driven. I love that it is definitely.
It is now, but it wasn't always though.
Right? Roller derby in its current form.
Right. Yeah.
I would say it's definitely female driven.
Yeah.
And certainly like the roller derby that I've been to and seen has been female driven.
Mine. That's my experience too. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do love that DIY part of it. I'm not really a huge DIY person. My wife definitely is, but I really appreciate that about people, you know, when they can just create stuff themselves. Mm-hmm. I love that part where it's like, they do the setup, they do the takedown, they run the, like oftentimes they'll be running the, maybe the concession, or it's just like really like grassrootsy kind of feel.
Just to interject real quick too. And I, you know, there's going to be, you know, cynical people out there like, well, if somebody gave them money, they'd take it. That's not necessarily true. And I know that's not true, because they don't want to lose control.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I just want to make that point before people are out there rolling their eyes. Like, what's that?
It hasn't happened yet. You know, like
it's
maintained. It's kind of like grassroots feel. Yeah. And I guess the other thing is just that it's also like a really queer kind of sport, you know, not I'm saying that everybody who does roller derby is queer. I'm just saying like a lot of queer people do roller derby.
It gives this
whole other sort of inclusivity piece that I really appreciate. And I'm not saying that every league is as inclusive as it could be or has been, but I do think that they're working on that and have worked on that. And it's more inclusive than a lot of athletic spaces, that's for sure. And so
it's a misfit sport in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
In a good way, right? In the best way possible.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
just lots of things to admire that aren't necessarily me. Like, I'm by no means punk rock. I'm by no means DIY. I'm certainly not as tough as any of those people, but all things I just really admire, I think.
Oh, and I should, and also, I'm not any of those things anymore. now I'm like, what do you mean you're out of almond milk? You know what I mean? Like, now I'm a vegan. So, you know, now I'm as soft can be. I'm none of those things anymore. I don't make it sound like I'm a cool guy by any stretch. But so again, about, like I said earlier, I love the author's notes and stuff. And you do a great thing at the end of this book is where you sort of give it's a brief, but thorough history of the sport. Clearly you did a lot of research, you know, and talked to a lot of people about it. And you beat me to it. I was going to ask you if you actually laced up and went out there, but it sounds like you got, you know, if you didn't lace up, you got pretty darn close by the sounds of it.
Yeah, well, I actually did. We have some amazing organizations here in Vancouver. We have a pretty good roller derby scene here in League, but we have a couple of like year-long companies, organizations that actually run like roller skating classes, and you can take roller derby classes. And they've even managed to sustain themselves throughout the pandemic in one form or another. And so I did actually, last January, I think, start taking roller skate classes, but unfortunately then the pandemic hit. And so they got derailed for a bit, and now they're sort of online. But I would definitely go back to that because I was just sort of starting to get into a little bit of a groove. And I wanted to just see, like, I'd roller skated before, and certainly ice skated before, but I wanted to, you know, just sort of make some connections too. And actually it was, one of the people that I met through doing that actually I got she agreed to write the contextual info at the end there, which was
awesome. Right on. Yeah. You probably mentioned her. I don't remember her name, but
yeah, I'm actually it's been a long time. So
no, that's fair. Lulu Demon.
That's Lucy? It. Yeah, Lucy, thank yep. you. Sorry, yeah. I really should remember that, but she did an amazing job. I just asked her whether she'd be willing to do it, and she's got lots of experience and wrote this perfect little snippet of the sport. So I really appreciated that. And so she, with another, this is like the female driven part, right? She and a friend of hers had started this amazing company that basically serves people who want to either learn how to roller skate or who want to get into roller derby. And it's they're doing awesome and it's super cool. It's definitely an inspiration for the book too.
That's very cool. I remember I used to go to this place called Wheelies, good name, right? And we would roller skate, mostly just because the girls were there, I admit, but you couldn't get them on the sidelines, you had to get out there. So we would go out there and cruise around, and I was definitely more of a shanty than a cat. I would just sort of drift it around, you know, lazily, and didn't attempt anything fancy. But I remember it was like, yeah, it was the thing to do. And it's a funny how it turned into just like kind of a trend for a lot of people, right? It just sort of came and went like so many things do. But I love when you know, you have characters like, again, Joe and Alma and, you know, B and Yolanda, these like old school hardcore people. And I love those scenes with Joe, you know, where Di is going to get her equipment for the first time. And it, you know, his garage becomes a time machine. And it's hard not to like get romantic about it. You know what I mean? Cause I've seen documentaries on roller skating and how it's, you know, through the years and stuff. And it looked like such a great time. And so much of what, you know, you're doing with this, the roller derby part of this book is a very modern thing. Like this, you know, this current version of roller derby with like everything we just talked about is really still not that old.
Mm-mm.
And there was, you know, decades in between. So what was it? So that was important to you, I assume, to have that bridge.
Yeah, I kind of just wanted to bring in some of the history as well without getting too bogged down in it.
Right.
It didn't quite fit in a lot of ways, but like the roller disco scene, you know, those characters you mentioned was kind of a shout out to, you know, the development of the history of the journey of roller derby and some of the sort of offshoot communities as well. Like I think I'd watched a documentary on roller disco and how it was such a huge part of Black communities in some different cities. And so like that piece
still is in a lot of the big cities
Yeah. And so I just wanted to, I was just fascinated by it. I was like drawn to it. I thought it was super cool. And so I just wanted to bring it in a little bit here and there throughout the book. And also involve those like older characters who like hold, you know, elders as who hold these histories too. You know, I think it's so important to include in books, even for young people, because sometimes we forget just how much value they can add, you know, and bring to you.
Yeah, for sure. And like, it just struck me as really authentic, because any roller derby person that I know or have met does have sort of an understanding of the roots of the sport, or even an appreciation for it. You know what I mean? They're not dismissive of it. Like, you know, disco sucks or whatever, you know, they have an understanding at least. And based on the amount of time that we spend with Joe in the book, I have no doubt Joe could convince me of anything, but could probably get me in skates within 10 minutes, I'm sure. Like, you know, his energy in particular in Alma too is just is incredible. And really, those are another great, really nice moment when Daya puts those skates on for the first time, and the way you describe the feeling, chef's kiss, really great. Daya goes without saying, you know, the whole point of this is to keep my attention as a reader, and you got to have a good main character. You do with Daya. She's sort of this, like, has this like contempt with hopelessness sort of thing going on right now with her. And like a lot of things we've talked about, she's suffering at the start of this book and the end too. Still, she's not. This isn't a complete turnaround, but one of the things she turns to is self-harm. So tricky subject. Makes a lot of people, you know, uneasy for sure. Talk to me about your approach with the self-harm aspect of this book.
Well, I am a high school teacher. I work with a lot of young people and have for many, many years now. And, you know, unfortunately, that's self-harm is a reality for a number of kids, more kids than I would wish. But and it's a reaction to all kinds of different things. And I don't claim to be an expert in it, although I definitely knew that I had a responsibility to do my homework on it for sure. Having not, you know, had any sort of first person experience with it myself. And so with her, when I was looking for the character who would be drawn to roller derby and for, you know, for some reason, you know, Daya appeared. I think part of it was like, how can I go far away from Nima, from King's Queens and In-Betweens? You know, like what kind of different character do I want to try and work with here? And Daya is quite different. You know, she is a hard shell, tough nut, and she is hurting in a way that I think just sort of lent itself to this idea of like, how do I punish myself? Like, how do I you know, really squash down these feelings that I'm having? And so, yeah, the bruising, though it's not as typical a form of self-harm from what I know, it obviously made sense for this particular story, and the involvement of roller derby. And so I definitely, you know, I'm blessed with so many counselors in my life, thanks to being a teacher. And so definitely drew on their experience. They sent me to several resources that were really helpful to just sort of get behind, you know, get into how does that make sense to somebody, right? Like, how does it make sense to actually physically hurt yourself? What does that do for you? What does it not do for you? How aware are they of its impact? Both its, you know, like it feels positive in some ways, but how much do they know it's actually harmful? Is it that in the moment? Is it after the moment? And so on. So it was really eye-opening for me to do that research too and get a little bit insight into some of the kids that I've taught and teach, which was really helpful. But yeah, for her, I think it's just been those scenes where she first sort of senses that bruising might be something that could help her in some way. Those came much later in the book. At the beginning of the book, it was more like, okay, there's this kid. She is suffering from, you know, her something quite tragic. And she looks to roller derby to like increase the chances of her being able to hurt herself. Those were the bare bones initially. And then all of the other stuff around like what actually happened to her, how did she make the connection between what happened and the bruising? All of that came much further down the line, actually.
Right. Well, I have almost no experience with it, a little bit of experience years ago, but certainly none where I could offer any advice. And if I would pull anything from the book, I think you talk about two very important things when it comes to self-harm. How important it is to be able to talk about it with somebody. Mm-hmm. If you have somebody you trust to do that, of course, in a safe space, right? That's a game changer, I think, for Daya in this book, especially. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, asking yourself or having someone ask the question, is anything you're doing helping? Is it making you a happier person? Mm-hmm. So two really important things I thought you brought to the surface there. And that's, of course, that's just the start of the journey, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it's not the end of it. It's not the light at the end of the tunnel. But I think those are two huge steps that you introduce in this book for her specifically, in her specific situation I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. That really helps. And one of the things I liked was, I guess there's a happy, I don't want to say there isn't a happy ending. There's a happy ending, I think, right? But it's not magic, right? One of the things I really appreciated about it was that, you know, this isn't like everyone's happy now, everyone's perfect, let's go, you know, right off into the sunset. I think there's still work to do, which is important because that gives that context, that real world feel that we sort of talked about early too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's not a celebratory ending.
Right.
The tone of the ending isn't like that. But there is not, and then there's no like closure necessarily, although there maybe is on some fronts, but right. But she's much further along, and the point is like she's open to something else, right?
Right. You're a big reader, I'm a big reader. We've read too many books where, you know, they wrap this thing up in a nice red bow and, you know, it's the Disney model, I guess, right? You know, the happily ever after, but that's not real life, is it? Mm-hmm. Listen, I really enjoyed Bruised quite a bit, and I think the character work is from top to bottom. I don't think there's a stinker in the bunch. There's a lot of them we didn't even talk about, and that's on purpose. And there's a lot of the story we didn't even get to, again, on purpose. So if anyone's out there listening, please don't feel that this is the all-encompassing conversation about Bruised, because there's a lot going on in this book with so many other characters and a lot more to dive into. And the representation in this book, I think, is fantastic. It's handled beautifully. It's emotionally resonant. It's sensitive. It's important. Again, the way you tackle Daya's particular situation, I think, is done with such care. It's clear, I think, that you have, you know, this approach to issues like this that is important, and I think we need more of. So is there anywhere in particular you'd like people to buy Bruised? I don't like pandemic profiteers myself, so we don't like to give money to that scary bald guy. Is there anywhere local in Vancouver you'd like to?
Yeah, my local indies are amazing. My favorites are Massey Books, which is an Indigenous run bookstore, Pulp Fiction, which is just down the street from me, Book Warehouse, and Western Sky Books are just four of many wonderful books. Oh, and kids' books too. They're amazing as well.
Perfect.
Lots of great places to pick up your books besides that
right
place that we won't name.
There's people live in areas, parts of Canada, especially it's a big empty country. Yeah. Don't have access to certain things, and online is the only way they can get books. So if you have to, of course, by all means, please. It's important you get this book in any way that you can. Libraries are a huge help, by the way, to people out there. Libraries is a big way to get help diversify people's reading, for sure. I can't thank you enough. Is there anything coming up you want to shout out to? Any events? What do you got? A launch event going?
March 23rd. Yep. You know, I'm actually not sure even when this podcast is coming out, to be honest. When is it coming out?
It'll be around that time. It'll be before.
That's awesome. No news yet as to what the launch will look like, but there will be a launch for sure. And look out in the summer, hopefully, when we are allowed to maybe be together, because my ideal plan is to have a roller skating party for the launch. So
wow. Oh man. Remember that? Remember events? Remember like convention? I'm totally screwed. Like my favorite things are conventions and concerts and movies. And it's just like, you know, no. So the thought of it scares the shit out of me. So I don't think we'll ever, I don't know. One day. And hopefully we get to a point where, you can do a roller skating launch. That would be fantastic, obviously, and very on brand. So, Tanya, have a great weekend. If I don't talk to you before, please enjoy the launch. And everyone out there, again, March 23rd, please go buy Bruised.
There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Tanya for taking the time to speak with me today. Like I said, Bruised is a lot of fun, but it also has a ton of heart, and I can't recommend it enough. It's out now, so head on over to TanyaBetheju.com to order a copy today. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen. Head on over to Cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.